to have that environment where people feel comfortable speaking up is what we call psychological safety, where people feel able to put their hands up and say, hey, this happened to me, I made this mistake, and everybody to say, you know, thank you for sharing.
Off-gassing, a scuba podcast with host Nick Hogle. In this episode, I sit down with Mike Mason, a human factors and diving instructor located in Australia. I first met Mike when I contacted him to enroll in the Level 1 course, a 10-week webinar series from Human Factors and Diving. Along with his work with the Human Diver, Mike is an active DM, a rebreather diver, and works with the Australian Air Force. I speak with Mike more about human factors in diving, his previous diving experiences, challenges going between open circuit and closed, and much more. Please enjoy. Mike, how are you doing this afternoon?
I am very well, thank you, Nick. Very well indeed.
Nice. How's the weather over there for you today?
It's been good, yeah. Probably low 30s, I guess, but no rain, a little bit of a breeze to take the edge off. I've been indoors doing some painting today, so I got a little bit hot and sweaty, but that's just a fact of life living in Australia.
What are you painting? Just some rooms inside the house?
Yeah, not this house. We've got, my wife and I own an investment property just nearby, and that's been just getting more and more tired over the last few years. With the old tenant moved out, we need to get it ready for new tenants. So we decided to do the painting ourselves, which is a bit more a good way of saving money, not having to pay a painter and decorator, but it does take time and effort. So all part of the fun.
I've at my house, I actually just sold my house in Austin. I was renting it out, and we did quite a bit of painting in there, and it seems like a really good idea at first. Like, yeah, we're gonna save money, this is gonna be great. And then halfway through, we're just kind of like, yeah, this is a little bit much.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. But no, man, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast today. I'm excited to hear about your story, hear about your journey. Yeah, I'll jump right in. So tell me about that first breath underwater. Tell me what led you to that moment. Tell me about that whole experience. Was it love at first breath? Was it, I hate this, I'm never doing this again? Tell me all about it.
Definitely leaning towards the former. I learned to dive back in the late 90s when I was at university in the UK. And we did an organized trip to Grenada in the Caribbean for a couple of weeks. We'd done our pool training in the UK. We went to Grenada. There was a little bit of pool refresher training when we got there. And then it was straight into the ocean, just all off the beach to start with. And I will most certainly never forget that first dive, kneeling on the sand in only about, you know, whatever it was, 5 meters, but board shorts, just looking up at the surface above me, 5 meters, just breathing from this regulator, thinking, this is all pretty cool. Yeah. So I quite enjoyed that. And that was where it all started.
Awesome. Awesome. So when you, after that first course, how long, how far did you go? Talk about the progression from there.
So after that first course was a fairly intense 2 week experience. It was doing the BSAC sports diver syllabus, which qualified us down to 28 meters, I think it was. So kind of similar to PADI, advanced open water. And the final dive of the 2 weeks was on a wreck called the Bianca C, which is one of the world's kind of better wreck dives, I think. Really, really cool. And I'll never forget that experience, because all the dives we'd done prior to that in Grenada were reef dives, not necessarily shallow, but the water was crystal clear and you could see the bottom from the surface. It was all quite simple. Whereas this dive on the Bianca C was down a shot line. I'll never forget this particular moment either. You know, halfway down and you've just got this line just stretching off into the darkness. You can't see the wreck. You can't see the surface. You're like, this is all a little bit weird, but it was really cool. And then all of a sudden this shipwreck just appears out of the gloom underneath, which was absolutely awesome. Really, really good fun. So that was in 1999, I think. And after that, I have to admit, my career kind of took a bit more of a front seat. Diving took a back seat. I didn't do any again for an awfully long time. But then when I was living in Australia the first time round in 2015, a friend of mine had gotten into scuba diving, and he showed me some pictures of the grey nurse sharks, which live, well, there's plenty of grey nurse shark sanctuaries on the Australia coast, on the East Australia coast. And he showed me the pictures of these grey nurses just not far from where I live at all. And I thought, that looks wicked. I need to get back into scuba diving. So I got a refresher course, went and saw these sharks myself, thought, this is brilliant, and never looked back. And that's about 8 years ago now, I guess. So I did a lot of diving in Australia. Then I moved back to the UK in 2017. North Scotland, which is not everybody's cup of tea, but the diving up there is actually pretty good, I can assure you. a lot of more diving with BSAC, lots of wreck diving and things up there. And then I moved back to Australia permanently a few years ago. I got my dive master qual. I work part-time as a dive master now. And I'm just going onwards and upwards, really. I do a lot of rebreather diving. I've got my Mod 1, so normoxic trimix, down to 60 meters. I'd like to do a lot more of that. I've finally got my own boat, so I can go and be a master of my own destiny a bit more and dive some more of the unexplored wrecks off this coast. The rest of the world is my oyster, I'm hoping.
No, awesome. Oh, man, I got tons of questions just from that. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about BSAC, because I know of the organization, obviously. I know that they have a little bit of higher standards. Like you were saying, the course that you took was, I'm assuming that was the open water course, but it was you're saying is like equivalent to an advanced open water with another agency. Tell me a little bit more about like BSAC in general, because I just don't really know, like, other than they're an agency out of Europe, I would assume, right?
No, that's fine. That's a fair assumption. Yep. So BSAC stands for British Subaqua Club. So it's very much, it's the UK, you know, does the majority of the training and diving in the UK. And it is what it says it is in that it's a club. So it's very much run by divers, for divers, distinctly non-profit. There's a BSAC kind of hierarchy, or an office. I can't remember for the life of me where it is in the UK, but that has, you know, a chairman, a head of training, all these sort of other people. But then you've got branches all over the UK and all over the world. In fact, I'm a member of Sydney, the Sydney branch of BSAC, which is predominantly expats, but there are branches all over the globe. The good thing about BSAC is, because it's a club run by divers for divers, it's not in the same vein as a lot of other training agencies where you kind of, you know, you rock up, you pay some money, and you're almost guaranteed to get your ticket, which I think does happen quite a bit in the dive world. It's a bit more, I would argue you have to earn it a bit more with BSAC, because there's no kind of financial, expectation that you're going to get the certification that you've applied for. So it's pretty good in that respect. And most people that do their training with BSAC do it in the UK in inland quarries often, which are quite cold and quite dark. A lot of the diving off the coast is also a little bit colder, a little bit darker. So it is quite adventurous. And I think your comment about the standards being perhaps a little bit higher is pretty valid, actually. I know when I've been overseas and gone and done some, tourist diving, and you show them your BSAC credentials, people tend to go, oh, okay, yeah. And they're reasonably confident that you're going to have an idea what you're doing, which hopefully I gave them that impression afterwards as well.
No, for sure. So what are some major... You know, obviously you just explained some, but like, what are some major differences between a club and an agency? Because I do hear that, you know, there's more clubs, I guess, in Europe as opposed to outside. Or is that not a correct statement?
To be honest, I'm not really sure if Europe is the more club centric than other parts of the world. The vast majority of my diving has either been in Scotland or on the east coast of Australia. I have dived elsewhere on the planet, obviously, but those are the two sort of main locations. And a club versus an agency, you'll get people, everybody in the club tends to live in the same area. You know, they tend to join the club that's local to them. So they'll, in BSAC, as an example, you would join up and you would, you know, meet the other people there. The club's instructors and supervisors would train you in BSAC, have a qualification called Ocean Diver, which is equivalent to paddy open water, essentially. Then from there, you'd go on to Sports Diver, which is the equivalent of Advanced Open Water. And then it goes up from there. But the idea is that within the club, you then become one of the dive leaders and then one of the instructors. And then you can bring the next generation of divers on. So it all kind of stays in-house, where the club gets to look after itself, which is quite a good way of doing business, I think. Not perfect. There are some certain drawbacks, but overall, I quite liked being part of a branch within BSAC when I was diving in the UK.
Okay, cool. And then my next question I wanted to ask is, tell me about the diving in Scotland. I just spoke to somebody not too long ago. They do a lot of mine diving in Scotland, but tell me about the diving. I'm assuming it's going to be cold, but I don't know much about it.
That's a fair assumption. It is cold, and we didn't do much diving in the winter because it was what you might call stupidly cold. I think because I lived in North Scotland, at a place called Lossiemouth, which is kind of about 3.5 hours north of Edinburgh. Most people can kind of get their head around that, I guess. But I lived on the coast, which was great. And we had our own fleet of ribs, so we could go and do all the diving we wanted to do whenever we wanted to do it. And most of our local dives were all wrecks. So there was probably about half a dozen wrecks within not too far away from the coast. There was we had one. I can't remember the life of me some of the names, but there was a fishing trawler down at about 25 meters, which normally would have shoals of fish and conger eels and stuff lurking in the nooks and crannies. There was a Wellington bomber not too far away in about 17 meters of water that crashed sometime around World War II. And there was a bit of wreckage on that was still around. Another wreck called the Gnar, which I think was about 100 years old, again in about 15, 16 meters of water. And that was quite funny. There was an old rubber boot that somehow had just managed to stand the test of time. So there's all this kind of, iron and steel and things, and then just this boot stuck out of the side of the wreckage. But yeah, it's relatively cold, but the water's relatively clear most of the time, and perhaps not as clear as it is here in Australia. But yeah, it was good. And it was quite adventurous. I quite enjoy the adventurous side of diving, where you can actually, you back roll off the boat, you get to the shot line, there's a bit of current, and you have to put a bit of effort in to get down the line. And then that I've never quite got over. I really enjoy that sensation when a wreck appears out of the gloom, when you're following the shot line down. I really enjoy that. So Scotland certainly has a lot of that to offer.
Awesome. So what was the prompting the move from Scotland to Australia to England?
That's a fair question, and the answer is relatively simple. With a lot of people, it was to do with work. So my background is in the British military. I was in the military for the British military for 20 years. I spent 3 years of it on an exchange posting here in Australia between 2014 and 2017. That's where I met my now wife. But once my Australian exchange was over, I had to go back to the UK, and I was sent to Scotland. So I went to live in Scotland for those 3 years. But then once my Royal Air Force career was over, it was far easier for me to move back to Australia to live with my wife and Amanda, because she's got two children. I had no real ties. So I moved back here in 2020, and I now work for the Australian Air Force. And that's my full-time job. But I'm also, as I say, a dive master, do a bit of that just casually off the coast here. So a bit of diving, a bit of flying. It keeps me busy. At the moment, painting a house as well.
Yeah, that sounds like you got a lot going on. So tell me about the diving in Australia where you're at. Is it pretty close to home, I'm assuming, just kind of like real close to where you live?
Yeah, it's good. It is. It's really close. It's really, and the diving here is pretty good. I live about half an hour south of a place called Port Stephens, which is about 2.5 hours north of Sydney, for people who don't know Australia very well. And it's a very, Port Stephens is a huge natural harbor estuary type place, but there is some absolutely fantastic shore diving in there. It's probably the consistently some of the best, certainly in terms of accessibility as well, the best shore diving in Australia, because there's a site called Fly Point, which is generally the best one. You can park your car, get changed out the back of your car, walk down some steps, you're in the water after about 10 meters of walking, and then you just submerge, swim about 20 meters out, which gets you about 10 meters of depth. And then within the next 2 minutes, you're in this sponge garden with lots of rocks, rocky ledges, and there's just fish and lobsters and nudibranchs. You'll get turtles, you'll get small sharks and wobbegongs. It's brilliant. And it's because it's a shore dive, the weather has to be absolutely awful for it to be ruined. So even if it's blowing a gale and you can't go offshore on a boat, you can generally get a shore dive in at Port Stephens. It's good. It's really good.
And then you said you moved into rebreather diving. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that? What unit are you on?
I've got an AP Inspiration, which I've trained on in the UK. To be honest, I think if I had my time again, I probably wouldn't get the AP, mainly because it's not that well supported in Australia. There are people I know that are qualified to service it and look after it and things, but if my unit breaks, I can't borrow any bits off anybody else because I don't know anybody around here that has one. But the reason I got one, because when I was in the UK working in the Royal Air Force, in the UK Armed Forces, they had a fantastic scheme where you could actually go and do what we call adventure training, whether that be diving or hill walking or mountaineering or skiing or sailing, all these adventurous activities. You could go and do those as part of your job, where they would actually train you in using all this gear and go and, yeah, just make you a better a team member. It's a really good sort of scheme to make people better military people with the use of outdoor pursuits to have a good time. Anyway, so there was a center in the UK that was focused on diving, and they had a rebreather training section within it. Because it's the UK, it was relatively AP-centric, because most people in the UK tend to dive AP rebreathers. So that's just that was all I knew, really. They gave me a unit for free for the week. The course didn't really cost me anything, so I got trained for nothing, which was brilliant, because yeah. Obviously it's not normally cheap to get trained on a rebreather. And I loved it. It was brilliant. I think rebreather diving is fantastic. It's quiet. You can stay down for longer. It's a bit of a faff getting the equipment on and off and getting it all set up and cleaned afterwards. But once you get into it, it's really, really good. Really enjoy it. So I bought a secondhand AP in the UK probably about, yeah, maybe 6 months before I left the country. I brought it over to Australia with me, and I use it quite a lot. It's brilliant. I really enjoy rebreather diving in this country as well. Yeah, it's great.
Cool. Do you, so I'm assuming, do you switch back from open circuit to closed circuit, or do you try to just mostly do closed circuit?
When I'm diving on my own terms, as it were, so just, you know, fun diving, if it's just me if I'm diving with my wife or with some of my friends, I'll tend to use the rebreather, mainly because although for a lot of the diving I do is quite shallow and quite accessible, and it's, you could easily argue the rebreather is a bit too much faff and hassle. But it's important that you keep using it to keep your skills current, because I do want to do a lot more stuff offshore with it. And I would rather, when I start doing that a bit more consistently this year, hopefully now I've got my own boat, my skills will be such that I can do it competently much more quickly. But yes, I do use open circuit when I do my dive mastering. So I know I'm going out on Wednesday, this Wednesday, to do a boat dive up at Broughton Island, and I'll be on open circuit there the same as all the people on the boat with me.
Okay. So I actually just did my first try dive on a couple of units, like a few at the beginning of December. And obviously there's, you know, quite a bit of challenge when you first start going into the rebreather, because it took, obviously, like me, I'm assuming a lot of people took a moment like, okay, I can't use my breath to control my buoyancy. Yeah. Do you have trouble going back and forth? Or is it just kind of like something that you can just, you fall right back into? Because I found myself at one point I was on the rebreather and I was just kind of, you know, hovering over a piece of coral or something trying to look. And usually when I'm getting that close, I start to like kind of breathe in to slow myself. And I'm like, this isn't doing anything. So do you find that challenging still to switch back and forth? Or is it kind of something you get used to?
I think I would say I get used to it. I'm not too bad at transferring buoyancy skills between open circuit and closed circuit. What I do find that I'm not very good at on open circuit now, actually, is gas consumption. I will, because on a rebreather, it doesn't really matter. You know, you can just breathe as much as you like, and it just goes round and round the loop, and your body just uses as much oxygen as it needs. On open circuit, as you know, it's quite important to be much better with gas consumption. For all the obvious reasons, but I find that when I go to open circuit, I have to really actually concentrate on my rate of breathing to avoid running out of gas quicker than I would like. So I find it actually harder to go back to open circuit and get the most out of it, I think.
Oh wow! Okay. It's challenges that, you know, obviously, like, you hear about it going in, but then when you're actually in the moment doing it, because it's become so natural to me to just breathe to control that fine tuning in the buoyancy. So when I hit the rebreather, it was like, nope, this is not in the cards anymore. So I thought that was kind of a fun thing, which I, you know, obviously have heard a lot of people go through that same sort of thing, just because it's a completely different thing than you're learning. But my my next question, obviously, so how I met you was through, I got your link through Gareth Locke. How did you link up and, you know, get involved with human factors and diving?
Okay. So when I was getting more into diving in the UK, back in, this probably going back about 5 years now, it's probably 2018, 2019. And I can't remember how I came across it as a, as an initial concept, whether it was on Facebook or on a website, but I discovered the human diver through Googling or Facebook. And I just thought, this all makes complete sense to me, because human factors, regardless of whether it's diving or in my professional background of flying, it's largely the same concepts. You just use different stories, different contexts to bring those concepts to life. So I found that I could just listen to what Gareth was talking about or read what he was writing about and think, this is brilliant. I love all this. I can completely relate to it. I've been using human factors in my professional life as a pilot for many, many years. So I just thought, this is great. How do I get involved? I wrote to Gareth, asked him some questions, some thoughts about some of the things that I was going through with my diving sort of career. And we built up a rapport. I joined the instructional team maybe about three and a half, four years ago now, I think. And I've never looked back. I really enjoy what the human diver is all about and the opportunities it can help bring to other people.
Yeah. No. And to be honest, I can't remember who I was talking to about that, but because I was trying to figure out, because it is such a great concept, especially to bring that into diving. And I was trying to remember, like, how did I come across it? Like, because I honestly can't remember it. But when you do finally stumble across it, you're like, this does make sense. This is very true. And I feel like it's not talked about enough or applied enough, I should say. So no, and obviously I'm very excited because we have the course coming up. Can you tell me a little bit about what is involved in the, so I've taken the level zero,
the essentials class.
Yeah, the essentials class. There we go. I've taken that online. What is all involved when you go into taking the level one, the 10-week program?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So the level one, as you said, is a 10-week program. It's a hour and a half webinar every week for 10 weeks. And we go through we pick essentially 10 aspects of human factors and how they relate to diving and just go through them in lots of detail one week at a time. The beauty of the webinar sessions is it allows people, you know, who want to come on board and learn more about it to ask questions, to share stories with me, but also with the team. There's no point in just having, you know, being me talking to you, Nick. The fact that we've got, I think there's about 12 people signed up already, which is brilliant, because the more people involved, the more people have got stories to share, experiences and thoughts to add to the conversation, and the more learning you can actually get out of it. So in the 90 minute session, the hour and a half session, I'll probably talk for, let's say, 10 minutes on, and we'll go through some slides. I'll talk about some examples to bring the concepts to life. And then it'll be a case of, right, okay, group, team, what are your thoughts? What are your key takeaways from what we just talked about? You guys can then add your thoughts. You can write them in the chat because it's run over Zoom, or you can talk about them over the microphone. And we just share some stories, some experiences, some thoughts. And then we go move on to another topic and do the same thing again. And then we'll generally do that for probably, let's call it an hour, maybe 70 minutes. And then that leaves about, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour for sort of more detailed question and discussions afterwards. And then between the weekly sessions, there's a bit of homework, which might sound like a bit of a chore, but the idea is that you can, during that homework, it's all focused on the topic we've just talked about during the webinar for the hour and a half. And you can go and think about in your own time a story or an experience that you've had that you can relate to the concepts, and then put it down in the community forum within the Human Diver website for me to look at, for other people to look at and comment on, so we can all learn from those experiences and take them forward. And the following week, we'll start by recapping some of those experiences and homework that people have done, that people have shared, and then we'll move on to the next subject. And that happens weekly for the 10 weeks. The Level Zero Essentials class that you mentioned is very much a case of you looking at some, you know, recorded material, pre-recorded material, and getting an idea of the concepts, but it's very much a case of this is just a sort of theory, and it's a one-way delivery, just you looking at a video in your own time. The beauty of the level one is it's a lot more of you responding to me and to your and to the other people on the course with your thoughts, your experiences. So there's much more reflection and detailed learning that can take place.
My question with that is, and I hope I'm using this term correctly, the just culture term. And that's that's basically, so it's an environment that allows somebody, or not allows, that's the wrong word to put it, that empowers somebody to speak up, right? Just culture, not, is that kind of correct? Is that a correct assumption, or am I off on that?
Kind of. So when you're creating the environment that empowers people to speak up, what you're actually talking about there is having what we call a psychologically safe environment. Now, that's very much related to a just culture. And the idea is, and to put this another way, to have a just culture where people can talk about mistakes that they've had, or sorry, mistakes that they've made, things that have gone wrong, and for other people to listen and you know, in a fair and just manner, that requires psychological safety to make it happen. So it's kind of related, but the idea is that to have that environment where people feel comfortable speaking up is what we call psychological safety, where people feel able to put their hands up and say, hey, this happened to me, I made this mistake, and everybody to say, you know, thank you for sharing, rather than shut up, Mike, you're an idiot, we don't want to hear from you again, because that's not going to exactly create that safe environment for me to speak up. So yeah, psychological safety is another way to think about it, and we'll go through this in a lot more detail on the course, is it's very much a proactive thing. So before we go and let's say you and I are going to go and do a wreck dive that we've never done before, and we want to have the environment where I want you to be able to say, hey, Mike, this might sound like a stupid question. First of all, no stupid questions, but you know, how do I find the bow of the wreck? And instead of me, if I just sort of say, well, what are you, stupid, Nick? It's obviously just the pointy bit at the end. That's not any use. So it's important for me to say, well, what we're going to do is go down to the wreck, head north, for example. You'll progress down the side of the wreck and it'll look like this. But then you might say, yeah, a friend of mine, or I did a dive on a wreck similar to this a couple of years ago, and this happened. We didn't plan our gas very well. So that's a case of, oh, okay, well, you're now, you know, actively contributing to the team's success to help us achieve our aims. And ultimately, the sort of top level of psychological safety we call challenger safety, which is where if somebody sees something potentially going quite badly wrong, they actually feel able to put their hands up and say, right, stop. We're actually going to potentially have a real serious emergency here unless we do X, Y, Z. So it's a kind of gradual build-up process before the dive, during the plan, during the brief, where people feel able to challenge and contribute and talk about lessons that they've got from other dives, creating that psychologically safe environment to allow all that. And then after the dive, once it's done, you reflect on it and you look back on what's happened with a just culture environment. And people can then talk about what happened, what they did well, what they did not so well, with that environment where people feel able to talk about those kind of things so that everybody can share those stories and move forward and learn to improve things for the next time. Hope that makes sense.
Yeah. No, it does. And you were speaking as an example, like just me and you, right? So usually when the numbers are a little bit smaller, that fear factor to speak up is a little bit less. So when the numbers are bigger, you know, say obviously we're not going in a team of 12, but like say the class, the 10-week program, there's 12 people in the program. What advice could you give either to somebody else not speaking about their experience or somebody speaking about their experience to be like, oh, it's okay, even though there's 12 people here? Because I feel like when there's more people, it's a little bit more scary, kind of like, you know, speaking in front of a big audience, right? Like the fear factor is a little bit more. So what pieces of advice can you give to make that a better environment or psychologically safe environment? Is that right? Sorry.
Yeah. Psychologically safe environment. Yeah. And that's an excellent point, Nick. The more people you've got there, within the team, within the group, especially if you don't know each other, the harder it is to be that person to put your hand up and say, hey, I've got a thought. Has anybody thought about this? I'm not sure about that, et cetera, et cetera. In answer to your question, though, the best way to do it is for the leaders, the people in positions of authority, to talk about their own mistakes, things that they've done wrong on a dive. So let's say we're going to go and do a hypothetical wreck dive in 30 meters of water in quite bad vis, quite poor current. And the last time I did this dive, I got lost on the wreck, or I almost ran out of gas, or something like that, where it got a little bit tricky. And you can pick whatever you want, but it's important as the leader, the person briefing the dive or running it, you talk to the group about a mistake that you've made and what you learned from it to take forward for future dives. And that way, by setting that example, showing that vulnerability that you as the leader who, you know, may have been put on this pedestal of authority where people think that you've got all the answers and you're brilliant. But if you put your hand up and say, do you know what? I made a mistake diving this wreck last time. This is what I learned from it. Hopefully you guys can learn something too. So if anybody else has got any mistakes to share any lessons to share, then feel free to speak up. By doing it as the leader, by setting the example, that empowers other people to do the same. And in my experience in flying, certainly, I've worked with all sorts of people in the military aviation world for the last 23 and a half years now. And by far the most credible pilots that I've worked with are the ones who stand up at the front of the room during a debrief after what could be quite a complicated mission, and they list the things that they did wrong. They list the mistakes that they made, and you just think, wow, you know, that guy is an awesome fighter pilot, but he's just told me all the things he did wrong. If he can make those mistakes, then I know it's okay for me to make mistakes and talk about them as well. So that's it. It's by far the most important thing is for the leader to set the example.
No, awesome. I love that. And actually, to be honest, because I took the essentials, I think it was probably close to 2 years ago now. And actually, before the class starts, my plan is to go through it all again, just so it's like kind of refreshed in my memory going in.
Yeah.
Then my next question is, so I just finished up the 10-week program. I really enjoyed it. There's actually another level behind or above that, right? Or the next step, do you want to talk about that? That would be the in-person meeting. Is that correct?
Yeah. Okay. So the level one class, the 10-week webinar that we've talked about, that it goes into some pretty detailed theory and allows people to share stories and experiences to try and bring that theory to life in quite a lot of depth. You know, there's a lot of sort of time there to cover those subjects. The level two class, the face-to-face class, that generally takes place over a weekend. It's just two full days back to back. And that's a little bit different because what it's about is it does have some of the theory, but it's kind of it's largely a kind of refresher of what we've talked about in the essentials or the level one class, albeit because you're in a face-to-face environment, it's a lot easier to have a quick, rapid fire discussion when you're sat around a classroom rather than over Zoom. The main learning benefit of the level two class is what we call Interlab. So this is a software simulation tool that we have where it involves teams of between sort of three and six people, and you're flying a spaceship. Now, you might think to yourself, why on earth would I want to do a diving course where I'm flying a spaceship? And that's a reasonable question. But the reason is because if we had some kind of scenario where it would be a case of, okay, guys, this is a diving situation, and I've got Nick, who is an experienced diver who's now just delving into the world of rebreathers, and then I've got somebody else, let's say Samantha, who's a brand new open water diver, maybe only 10 dives to her name. It would be far more natural for Nick to want to take command, take charge, and Samantha to sort of fall into the background, because that's just the nature of the kind of environment you'd find yourselves in. Most people on this diving class have never flown a spaceship before, so everybody is at ground zero. Everybody starts from scratch, just the same common ground. But don't worry, you haven't got to sort of be an expert, NASA astronaut candidate, nothing like that. The idea is that the software is deliberately designed such that you have to, as a team, work together, and you've got different laptop stations which act as sort of different cockpits within the space station, but you've only got half the information you need. So you have to get the other bits of information from other parts of your team to make the spaceship, make the mission function. And the idea is that you do these missions, they deliberately have traps in them to kind of catch you out and things will go wrong. You use your non-technical skills, so your communication, teamwork, leadership is going to be required. How do you enhance each other's situation awareness to prioritize, make the right decisions at the right time to achieve mission success? And we'll do 5 missions during the scope of the weekend. We will actively and thoroughly debrief each mission, looking at what we can take away to improve for the next time. We'll draw parallels from diving. And trust me, there are a lot of parallels you can draw from your diving. And because everybody actually gets fully involved in these missions, the self-reflection during the debrief is so much more thorough that the learning is so much greater as well. Because if it's just a lot of courses to do with, human factors or non-technical skills, a lot of it can just be PowerPoint. Or, I do all the talking. You might ask a couple of questions, but you don't really get immersed in what's going on. I don't give you any, or it's very difficult to give people actual practical exercises where they can put these skills into practice. The beauty of the Human Factors Level 2 class is that's exactly what we do. We give you this spaceship and we say, go and fly the spaceship. We don't get me wrong. We teach you how to fly the spaceship first, but you have to use those non-technical skills as a team to achieve mission success. And you look at how you behave individually when you're under pressure. You look at how your team behaves when they're under pressure. What behaviors do you need to address and improve and develop and potentially create from scratch to achieve success? And what parallels can you draw into your diving? It's a really successful course. And the vast majority of people come away from it thinking, that was not what I expected. That was brilliant. Really enjoyed it. And everybody that I've ever certainly trained. And I think the Human Diver as an organization has trained probably about 500 people globally on this class now. The vast majority, all but the odd one or two people, think the course is brilliant. And it makes you a better diver. It teaches you how to think about your diving rather than actually your sort of technical skills within it.
No, I like that. And actually, to be honest, because I know you can go from essentials to the in-person class. You don't need the 10-week program. So I was going to look for it eventually. And then, but in the past, so I moved out to Malaysia not 2 years ago, but about a little over a year and a half ago, probably about a year and a half. And I was, there wasn't really much, or I couldn't find much out here. So I was actually really happy to get linked up with you to be able to take this next course, the 10-week program. But do you have any in-person classes coming up in 24, or is there anything in this area of the world?
Generally, what I will do is engage with people who want the class to be run. So if we can find a group of between 4 and 6 people in Southeast Asia, Malaysia, Singapore, the Philippines, Indonesia, etc., that want to do the class, then I'll come and do the class. That's all part of the game. That's generally how I worked in Australia so far. I've done a couple of classes over in Perth with a dive shop over there that I built a relationship with. I've done 2 classes up at Manta Lodge and Stradbroke Island with the team there. I've already got 2 more classes booked for the middle of this year as well. I'm in consultation with a chap in South Australia, down in Adelaide. I went to Melbourne in November. I'm hopefully going back there this year. So I'm trying to get the message out there as much as I can in this part of the world, in Australasia and Southeast Asia. But really, it comes down to, if people are interested in the face-to-face class, then I will come and provide the training. It's great fun. You'll have a great time. And I love delivering it as well. So it works both ways.
So Australia is a place that I've had a fascination about since I was a little kid, probably the Crocodile Dundee movies. Sorry, hopefully that's not a sacrilegious thing to say.
That's the real Australia.
but no, it's a place that I've wanted to go. So, if there's, I'll have to try to figure out, when I can get some dates looked up and figured out, that'd be great to come and take that course. Another question I wanted to ask is, so you being a dive master, like, not necessarily, I guess it's not how you're applying this to the being a dive master, helping out with a course. But if you were going into an open water course, say I was the student going into an open water course, why would it be beneficial for me to take a human factors and diving course? Because I'm sure you must get that question a lot. I would assume so. Just people like, oh, what is this? What's all involved? So would you suggest for someone to? Because I could see the benefits, obviously, but somebody that might not know as much. And I know you've explained a lot of it throughout this conversation, but just kind of like key takeaways from that? Key takeaways from like why you think it would be a benefit, or why you know it would be a benefit, I should say.
There's three kind of key things that human factors training enable. And I'll focus on two of them. So the first one is safety. Human factors, or knowledge of human factors and how to apply them, and whether that's as a, you know, a master instructor or a brand new open water student diver, if you've got an idea of how humans behave and humans interact with each other, with their environment, with their equipment, then you will be better placed to be a safer diver, because you'll be able to think ahead, anticipate potential problems, communicate better with your team, with your fellow students, with your instructor, ask questions in a perhaps a more appropriate manner to get the information you want and help ensure that the team will stay safe. So safety is kind of the first one. However, I am a realist, and I know that a lot of people consider safety to be quite boring. And you know what? I can see why. In its pure form, safety is not particularly interesting. So I get that. So what I try and focus on actually is that if you can, again, embrace human factors, have an understanding of the concepts, and think how you can apply them to your diving, it will allow you to be a better diver, and it will allow you to be a better diver quicker. Your rate of learning, your rate of improvement, the way you can learn skills, improve on those skills, and move on to, you know, the next set of skills will accelerate. You will be a better diver quicker. And actually, the third one, which is also worth highlighting, is humans, we like getting better quicker. We like working as a team. We're social animals. These skills, these concepts, these ideas, by bringing them to life, by getting them involved in your diving, you'll have more fun as a diver as well. So those are the three things. Safety is one. Some people find that a little bit boring. Okay, fine, but that's a big part of what we're about. But you will improve quicker. You will be a better diver quicker, and you will have more fun. Those are the three reasons why anybody should take human factors training, whether you're a brand new open water diver just going for dive one, or you're a master instructor with, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 dives in your logbook, or even more.
No, I love that answer, man. And like I said, I don't, and I really need to figure out how I came across it. It's probably just word of mouth, or it's out there, but no, I really, really did enjoy the class, and I definitely felt like it makes you think, look at things in a different light. So it's and I can completely agree with that. Random question for you, because you obviously spend a lot of time underwater and obviously spend a lot of time in the air. Which is your preference, in the air or under the water?
Oh, that's a good question. If I had a choice between one or two, it would almost certainly be under the water now, because I like flying. Don't get me wrong. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it for a living. But I've been doing it for a long time now. and I don't get to dive anywhere near as much as I get to fly. So if it's a choice of one or the other, I'll generally want to go diving, because I don't get to do it as much. So the novelty value certainly hasn't worn off.
Just because I'm curious. So when you were first joining the military, and I'm assuming you can kind of figure out which route to go, was it just like, did you know beforehand, like, I want to fly? Was that like, just, did you 100% you knew going in?
Yeah, my dad was a military pilot as well in the Royal Air Force. So I kind of grew up with it. It was something that I'd seen as a young boy growing up, going to the air shows, going to dad's, you know, squadrons. We lived in Germany when I was a young kid, and then moved back to the UK. So I remember seeing all these airplanes and just thinking, yeah, this is cool. I'd like to do this. So yeah, it was something I'd always wanted to do ever since I can remember. It was something I'd always wanted to do. So it was a natural progression for me.
Okay. Can you tell me some similarities? Is there some similarities between flying and diving? I don't know if that's a dumb question or not, but it was just kind of curious.
No, I mean, as we said earlier, there's no such thing as a dumb question. I think the main thing that it's where human factors especially kind of has a part to play. Humans were not designed to fly, and we also weren't designed to spend lots of time under the water, which means that if we want to do those things, we rely on, you know, equipment that allows us to do those sort of things. Yes, okay, there are free divers that go and do their sort of free diving thing, but that's a different sort of subject. But if you want to get into flying airplanes, or you want to get into scuba diving, you have to use equipment, and you have to know how to get the most out of that equipment requires you know, if you like, a human brain to get the most out of it. So, and one thing I've definitely learned through my my career in aeroplanes, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter how sophisticated the aeroplane is, how much money the government has spent buying all these aeroplanes and radars and missiles and stuff. A lot of it comes down to the man within the machine and how well that person is trained to deal with the situations they find themselves in. And that's the same for diving. You know, you can have the shiniest rebreather in the world. You can have the most fantastic dive computer with all the functionality you want. But if you're not thinking about how to be the best diver you can be, and things start to go wrong, it is very likely that you will fail and you could seriously hurt yourself. And that's exactly the same with aeroplanes.
Yeah. Okay, man. So last couple questions before I let you go. You sure. have an open weekend. The boat is fueled up. And where are you going for a diving? What's like a perfect day of diving for you? Where are you going? Oh, what are you going to do?
Well, my list of perfect days keeps getting longer. I think so. What I do around here, actually, these are the weekends I do actually ponder now. So I would put the boat in at Port Stephens with my wife, Amanda. And we would go offshore. We'd head up to a place called Seal Rocks, which is probably about 20 nautical miles up the coast. I'd probably arrange to meet a couple of other people there, but they would meet us on the beach. There's no boat ramps there, so I'd just get the boat in towards the beach. People, other divers could come on board the boat. And then there's a couple of wrecks, which I really want to go and explore this year, that are down at sort of the 50, 60 meter depth mark. We'd go and do those. Then Amanda, who likes diving but doesn't really like doing the deep stuff, she and I can go and do a dive with the grey nurse sharks around Seal Rocks themselves, because that's another one of the grey nurse shark sanctuaries. But it's quite far away from most of the other boat ramps, so relatively unspoiled. The sharks don't get much attention. And then we'll drop the other divers off on the beach, and then Amanda and I can go to Broughton Island, which is a nice little archipelago, which is, where, as I say, where the grey nurse sharks live, just near where we are. But there's plenty of little anchorages there, and we just spend the night relaxing with a barbecue and a bottle of wine on the boat. That's the idea.
That sounds amazing, man. Yeah, that sounds really fun. All right, and my last question for you is, so, you know, someone that's about to sign up for a course, say, you know, well, I'll ask for about human diver or human factors diving. But, you know, when most people sign up for a course, they're doing like a lot of prep work. They're like, okay, I need to do all of this. Obviously, there's that little bit of work that needs to be done before the first module, I think, for the 10-week course. What advice would you have for someone that just signed up for the course and they want to prep for it? Is it like things that you could do to prep more, or is it just kind of just sign up and show up? Like, what advice would you have for the person going into the human factors and diving course, the 10-week program, or even the in-person class?
With any of it, really, it's, I would encourage people to come with an open mind, have some things that you perhaps want answers to, some questions based on experiences you've got. You know, you said yourself, if you're in a, or you had a question earlier, I'm in a team of 10 divers and I want to ask a question. What sets that team up to be able to enable me to ask that question? Well, that it's best if the leader sets the example. That's the kind of, those are the kind of questions which you get asked all the time. So when you're coming on a human factors course, come up with some scenarios that you want answers to. Generally, that's when we do the any class, we'll say, right, you know, what do you guys want to get out of the program? So that allows me to shape the training to give you help, you know, help provide you the answers that you need. In terms of actual preparation, there's nothing required for the 10-week class at all. It is, you can come with no human factors knowledge whatsoever. The idea is that we really do start from the basics, giving people hopefully what I think is all the information they need. But, you know, the idea is that I'm there sort of forever as a resource. So people have got more questions, more things they want information on, then ask me, because that's what I'm here for. That's what the human diver is all about, helping people improve their diving. There's no prior training required or prior experience required for the level one class at all. The only training, or sorry, prerequisites for the level two class are that you have to have done the essentials. And the logic there is that the theory on the two-day class is covered relatively quickly, because most of the learning, most of the training comes from doing those interlab space missions where you get involved, you practice the skills, and then you debrief and reflect on them to learn for next time. And if you haven't done the essentials class, you're going to struggle with some of the basic concepts, the language, the terminology that we use. If you've done the level one class, though, that's like the essentials class on steroids. So you're already well set up to get the most out of the level two class.
Well, Mike, I really, really want to thank you for taking the time out to join the podcast today. I absolutely look forward to the start of the class. And no, I just want to say thank you. It's incredible to hear about your journey. And hopefully, is there more painting in store for you, or is that all done for the weekend?
I think it's all done. It's 7 p.m. now, so I think we're all done for the weekend. But most of my evenings this week are going to be a little bit busy with painting, I think, until we get this house ready.
Well, no, once again, man, I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much for coming on to the podcast today.
No worries, Nick. All I was going to add, if I may, before we sign off, is if people want to know more about the level one class or want to sign up, feel free to send me an email. It's mike.mason, that's mike.mason, at thehumandiver.com.
Off-gassing, a scuba podcast.